This is Eleanor Swent, and we're continuing the interview with Bud Wilson in Los Altos, California, on July 31st, 1997. All right, we're continuing after an interview yesterday. This is one reason I like to have consecutive interviews and have them kind of close together, because I think it works better. You get a chance to think about what you said yesterday and maybe add to it.
Yesterday, I think my remarks about General Electric Company were mainly negative and having to do with frustrations I had with working with those folks. But I think, overlook the positive factors involved in my experience at General Electric Company. I was fascinated with their management style and learned a lot about management from them. General Electric Company, GE, is keen on developing manpower. They really, I thought, went a little bit overboard.
I thought we turned that off.
No, that's a fact. Don't turn it off. As I said, I think I learned a lot about management and developing people skills that I hadn't given particular attention to before that time. Another positive factor was having a relationship with the second and third layers of management at GE. There's so many fine people.
This isn't going to work. We'll have to wait till that fax is over. Cause these mics are so sensitive,
yeah.
They pick up everything.
I don't think I'm saying this very well.
Well, maybe we can just talk over it in the annual reports. Of course, Welch makes a big point of his emphasis on people as the most important.
Yeah, of course, I described to you what I,
mm-hmm.
Welch said a lot of things that were just simply not true.
Mm-hmm.
That he would allow units to do their own thing. Well, baloney. He was on the backs of the management people constantly. Perhaps those whom he favored, like Hood, some others, maybe he let them go, but Chief Hood.
Really? Okay. Well, we'll just have to wait.
Faxes. facsimile machines are marvelous institutions.
Mm-hmm, they are. This is coming from England?
No, this is coming from across the bay. This is my son-in-law.
Oh.
One of my son-in-law.
Now, is that it? There's something else that's making a lot of noise in the background. I don't know how to
turn this off.
That helps a lot. Yeah. These things are so.
This is still going.
Oh. These mics are so sensitive that they pick up all this stuff.
What kind of things should we talk about?
Well, let's talk about management style a minute if you want to. One of the things that you were noted for, I think, at Utah, people said that your door was always open and that you were always accessible. You were, well, how do you evaluate yourself? And then,
well, I guess I hadn't thought much about it. You know.
And then compare it with what you found at GE. Was Welsh's door open?
No.
Yours was, I think. That's what I've been told.
Yeah, well, you know, Lee, I was fortunate to have some fine people working for me. You know.
Still getting a lot of noise.
Well, it's still coming out of that fact.
Nothing's coming out, though. There it goes. Okay, all right. Okay.
Wait a minute.
Well, if you talk loudly enough, it'll come over this, that's fine. You were fortunate, she said.
Were we recording?
You're okay.
Oh, I see, okay,
yeah.
Well. Yeah, I was talking about open door management. We were a company that had a relatively small management team, and the fellows were first class, and it seemed like we were all friends, worked together, and I had great respect for those folks and great confidence in them. So we really didn't have any problems. Didn't have any problems between us. Some other people, you know, other companies have a much more formal management style.
That's okay. That's all right. Is that the end?
Mm. Yeah, it's the end.
Oh, okay.
No, we can relax.
Good. Okay. Well, what about, I noticed in one of these articles about Escondida, it mentions that the employee dining room was a big change from Codelco, that Codelco had several levels of dining facilities, and one of the things that Escondida put in, which was a revolutionary move, was one common employee dining room.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Was this done consciously?
Consciously, yeah.
It was?
Yeah.
Whose idea was that?
Well, Bob Hickman was, Bob Hickman reported to Keith Wallace, put Escondida together, and we, our recollection of our political problems in Australia was fresh in our mind when we were doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to be sure that we didn't get booby-trapped as we were in Australia by thinking we could just do our job and keep our heads down and everything would be right.
Mm-hmm.
So in our planning, we stressed government relations, public relations, employee relations, and particularly we wanted to, at the mine, avoid some of the union problems that other people, other companies had had. And we hoped that we could build a workforce that was not organized by the Chilean unions.
You were able,
and we
you were
so.
Allowed to do that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where is
so
this?
So that, you know, that dining room was just one of the things that, you know, Hickman thought would be important in establishing better management employee relations than
mm-hmm.
Codelco had. And I think it worked.
Where is Escondida in relation to the other mining?
Well, Escondida is due east of Antofagasta, 100 miles, which would put it south by 70 or 80 miles from the big copper mines operated by Codelco.
So you were able to keep some sort of individuality there?
Yeah, we were. Not entirely, but so we were careful and tried to be careful in the selection of employees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to get really, Wallace is a guy steered the development of Escondida. And, know the facts behind that. We did have to talk to Keith. God. Gee.
If you can, that would. But that interrupts your business. I'm
sorry. Oh, it's going to go on the papers. Out.
Sorry to do that. So that was a conscious decision then to go that route. What had been your style in San Francisco?
Style in San Francisco?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. We just, management worked together.
Mm-hmm.
I think you said, someone said I had an open door policy. I think that's right. I would talk to anybody who had something to talk about.
Did you have an employee dining room?
No. Didn't need one.
Mm-hmm, yeah. And what about GE?
Well, GE was built on being a heck of a lot larger company. You know, they had a far different style, much more formal than I'd been accustomed to. Had an awful lot of people involved in examining what other people were doing, and particularly
they won't let you do that. Okay. They had a lot of human relations people, right?
Yeah, they did. Under Reg Jones, they had an awful lot of people involved in examining investment proposals. Some called it Reg's security blanket. All these folks devoted to redoing proposals and recommendations that others made. Remember one occasion in a relatively large meeting in the GE headquarters office, discussed the business plan for the coming year, and this discussion went on almost all day, and finally at the end of the day, Reg Jones got up personally and collected every copy of the plan, put them in a safe.
Oh. Put them in his safe?
Yeah, because he said that he didn't want, I've got to do something here. Nick?
Well, let's just relax and let it finish, and maybe it'll.
Why don't we move someplace? Let's move out of this room.
Okay. All right. We've had some interruptions with the fax machine here. Let's start all over and see. How we go. Well, some historian 100 years from now is going to get an interesting look at what life was like in 1997 with the fax machines and the yeah, they're a mixed blessing sometimes, but they're wonderful. You've got a lot of equipment here. My goodness, you've got, what do you have? You've got a copy machine, a printer, a huge Rolodex, a computer, an electric pencil sharpener, a fax. What's that over there?
Oh, that's a printer. I used to use a Quicken and print my checks on that thing.
Oh, I see.
But I found that so confusing, I finally gave up on it.
Okay. Then on your desk, you've got another.
Well, that's just a television there.
A television, okay. And a phone. And no wonder
there's a flatbed scanner down there that I haven't hooked up yet.
Oh, what are you going to do with that?
Well, yeah, I have some old photographs that I thought would be fun to play with on a computer and try to enhance them. And, but I haven't gotten very far yet.
Huh. That's the very latest gadget, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm afraid that one is obsolete even before I hooked it up.
Really? Huh. Are you a photographer? Do you enjoy photography?
No, not really a photographer, but I got interested in what one can do with, you know, improving images by digitizing them and playing with them on a computer. So I have that yet to perfect.
What sort of photographs are you doing? Your game pictures?
Well, I've got a photograph, for example, of my grandfather. Sitting way out above a string of mules pulling a harvester. There are 20 mules out in front of him.
Well.
And it's not a very good picture, and that's the one I thought I'm going to play with when I have time. And that probably dates back to 1900, so it's 100 years old.
Well, that would be a lot of fun. So, that's a whole new hobby,
I don't have time for all my hobbies.
No. I have known about that one.
Well, so far this has been a kind of a disjointed session.
Yeah, we hadn't gotten off to a very good start, so let's get off now. Yesterday went so extremely well, I guess, that we're going to have to get back into stride here a bit.
Let's start talking about PHP.
All right, let's do that.
I think I said yesterday when BHP acquired Utah, it was really a whole different ball game because we were now owned by a company that was familiar with the natural resource business, wanted to enhance it, liked what we were doing, and were particularly attracted, of course, to the coking coal holdings we had in Queensland. But more to the point, I think, was Jim McNeil, who was chairman of BHP at the time the acquisition was negotiated with GE, a man I had known for a long time and had come to respect. I guess Jim and I had become quite friendly over the years. But he made it clear early in the conversations that he admired what Utah folks had done and liked the people. So different.
Where were these conversations taking place?
Well, really the negotiations were conducted by John Burlingame.
Well, I'm thinking of the informal conversations before the actual negotiations.
Oh, the informal?
Where were you having these kinds of informal exchanges?
Just kind of all over the world. Indonesia,
Were you just?
Deb and I were in Johannesburg, South Africa, and we ran into Jim McNeil and his wife, and it just seemed like we were.
You were staying at the same hotel?
Yeah, we were. Mm-hmm. So our paths crossed reasonably often, and
there was something about a conversation in Jakarta.
Well, that was, that was in the old, really, I suppose that was probably in 1969, that Jim's predecessor, the then chairman of BHP, was suggesting that it would be nice if Utah and BHP would collaborate on coal mines in Queensland. And we didn't need BHP at that point, and I think I may have said something to that effect.
How did the idea actually germinate then?
The idea germinated? Well, I think the idea germinated. First, I explained that Welch decided to sell the company, get out of the mining business, mm-hmm. hopefully to sell it as a going unit. And when he I think that I suggested to Burlingame that BHP would be a reasonable shot. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, maybe somebody else had mentioned that to Burlingame. I can't be sure. But I had played no part in the negotiation. I was left out of it. I think I was quite happy to be left out of it. It was a GE matter, not a Utah matter. But then, you know, when we became BHP,
maybe the best thing to do is just let it. Maybe better just wait till it comes through.
Oh, I don't want to mess with it.
Is it going to be a fact?
I think I shut that off now. That son-in-law wants me to pay some of his bills. That's what's going on here. Damn.
Well, that's pretty important.
Yeah, I guess so.
Yeah, it is.
All right, we on the air?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, I think I was about to say that when Jim McNeil came to San Francisco, while the negotiations were taking place, and I guess toward the end, and before he would agree to the deal, he told me that he wished assurance from me that I would stay as head of Utah for at least 5 years, and He said that if I didn't agree, then he wouldn't cut the deal.
Hmm.
And I told him I would, and then I think perhaps that was the last day. Then they had a handshake, and McNeil came back to my office and asked me to join the board of BHP. That's when my travels really started.
Mm-hmm.
He told me that I'd be required to make only half the meetings. It'd be 6 trips to Australia, then about once a month. And it started out that way, but very, very quickly, BHP got involved in an attempted takeover by a man named Robert Holmes of Court.
Ah, yes.
And boy, the meetings were fast and furious. So I flew to Australia at least once a month.
Mm. You'd been going there regularly, though.
Yes, I have,
anyway.
But not with a frequency.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trying to run a business in San Francisco and dash to Australia, I could do the whole turnaround in 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
That was tough.
That's punishing.
And being a director of BHP was a very interesting assignment. I learned that the Australians are a lot different from Americans. Their background, I think, probably explains it.
Can you give some examples?
Yeah, I can. I hope this is never read by a... Turn it off.
Okay.
I don't know. All right. We were just in Australia.
Starting to talk about the BHP board, and you said the Australians were so different, and I asked you to give an example of illustrating the difference between their approach to things and yours. You had just thought of a good example at the moment that we got called off.
Yeah, well, I hesitated because I didn't, I don't want to be critical, but an example. The BHP directors were very conscious of their position of being the director of the largest corporation in Australia. And were very conscious of their role in Australian business community and role in society. One of the directors was a chairman of a real estate development firm in Sydney, and that firm got in trouble. As I recall, the managing director of the firm misspent money, took money from the company for his own benefit. So there was a great big flap in the newspapers and the newspapers were holding this PHP director, whose name was Alex Ogilvy, holding him responsible. And the press was really, really on the subject. And I received a call in San Francisco from the chairman of PHP, who was Jim Balderstone. Jim said, be sure and make the meeting next week because we have some serious matters to discuss with Alex Ogilvy. So I got there, and the matters that they wanted to discuss were, should Ogilvy be asked to resign from the PHP board? And by golly, they had a meeting, board meeting. They asked Ogilvy to defend himself. He stood up and said his piece. While he was chairman of the company, he had no knowledge of what this fellow was doing and thought it was unjust that he be held responsible. And the chairman excused him from the meeting, and the chairman said, we shall now vote. An aye vote is a vote to ask Alex to resign. A nay vote is, of course, the contrary. I was sitting on Balderstone's left. There were 12 of us at the meeting. Balderstone started on his right. And every person voted aye, till it got to me and I said no. And I stood up and I said, I come from an environment in which we believe people innocent until they're proven guilty. And I said, we are about to ruin the reputation and the life of a man on newspaper accusations and innuendo. And I said, I think it's terribly wrong. And I said, I will not. So the chairman said, righto, I will take another vote. Huh. Everyone voted no.
So you turned it around.
Could you believe that? I was flabbergasted. But that's the... Press has a great impact on negative press has a great impact on the folks involved in the business community over there. And I know you sure have a lot of it.
Would that have been handled differently here? Do you think it's a national day?
Oh, I would never have gone to that point. Oh, good heavens, you wouldn't even suggest kicking a man off a board on the basis of some media accusations. Mm-hmm. No. Ridiculous. So, well, that's one example.
Very good one. You had mentioned Holmes a Court.
Yeah.
Well,
Robert Holmes a Court was attempted to take over BHP. Was unsuccessful in the takeover attempt, but did acquire enough stock to force himself on the board. But he became a director of BHP.
Mm-hmm.
And was really a thorn in the side of the BHP management, because he opposed, as a matter of course, anything that, or most anything that BHP wished to do.
Hmm.
I think we're going to have to. That's over now. I think maybe we should. I'll close this a little. We've got competition from Lamar out here.
And
the facts, so it's getting pretty noisy. Now, the facts have stopped, right?
Mm-hmm.
Good. I hope we can sort that out. Who were some of the other people on the board?
On the BHP board?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I'm going to have to refer to a list of directors.
Okay, all right. Well, that was a good example of a different way of operating, though. Can you think of any others?
Yeah, well, you know, for another example, when it was first suggested that BHP list its American depository receipts on the New York Stock Exchange, the board voted it down because by the rules of the New York Stock Exchange, they would have to reveal, each director would have to reveal his holdings in BHP. And they didn't wish to do that. So it took them, I think, 2 years to finally come around listing the ADRs.
Mm-hmm.
Played it close to the vest,
Well, you know, they were concerned that the unions would find some way to retaliate. A lot of concern that I wouldn't have thought necessary, but it sure bothered them. I think it comes out of the fact that Australia is, for the most part, an egalitarian society.
Mm-hmm.
There are only a few, relatively few, who stick their heads up and they just don't like to do that. Don't want to bring attention to themselves. Australia has more, I was told, that more newspaper reporters per capita than any place else in the world.
Oh, really?
Boy, the press, they have to have something right about it.
Mm-hmm.
Great fuss.
Did they ever pick on you?
No. Oh yeah, before BHP acquired us, when we had the strike that I referred to, we were in the press quite a bit. Then even before that, when the Labor government came into power, it was popular to criticize foreign investment in the natural resource business in Australia. Mm-hmm. That's when we really took a shellacking in the press. And I think I referred to that about Escondida. We learned a lesson, a very bitter one. And, thinking in Australia when we started, we were very successful. We thought that if we were good corporate citizens, kept our heads down, and kept out of the newspapers, everything would be right. But boy, that doesn't work when you're, yeah. when you're a successful foreigner.
Mm.
And you know, the Labor government criticized Utah, made threats to nationalize the company, all sorts of stuff.
Were there ever any things aimed personally at you?
Oh, I don't think so.
No.
Not that I recall.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, you'll be, this is back during the time of the strike. When the Labor government threatened to nationalize Utah, I was in Singapore with a daughter and got a call from San Francisco. This has been going on. So we changed plans and went to Australia. We spent a month in Australia trying to sort out the politics of the situation and the legal aspects. At one point, I took my daughter to Canberra, and we had a meeting with Doug Anthony, who was head of the Country Party and head of the opposition coalition. And I finished my chat with Anthony, and he asked my daughter if she'd like to go on the floor of Parliament. Well, sure, that'd be great. So we were ushered in, not in the visitor's gallery, but down on the floor. They had about a half a dozen seats there, and, just behind the back benches. And when we walked in, the Minister of Mines and Energy, his name was Rex Connor, was making the speech. And he saw me. And he stopped his speech and he pointed at me and he said, "There's the man who is turning our country into a quarry. There's the man who should be done away with." And I thought my daughter was going to faint. Mm-hmm. She was sure that somebody's going to shoot us right there.
Mm.
You know, on the floor of Parliament, they're immune from any action. Well, you can't accuse a parliamentarian of slander if he says it on the floor. That was most exciting.
What about Alan Bond? Did you ever have any dealings?
No, I met Alan Bond once or twice. I had nothing to do with him.
He never got into BHP?
No, he didn't get into BHP. In order to stave off the Holmes of Court incursion, BHP made a deal with I should have brought this up. No, I can't remember names.
We can fill it in later.
Yeah.
Was it another mining company? Or?
No, this was a brewery.
Oh.
And the man who was chairman of the company, I think BHP bought something like 200 billion. BHP and this company exchanged shares, and then the chairman was brought on board of BHP.
Mm.
I'll put these names together later.
Yeah.
That was a very upsetting time for BHP. Been an awful time.
Great time for the press.
Yeah.
But that was that while you were on the board?
Yeah, I was on the board. I came on the board just at the time that Holmes of Court was making his first moves.
Mm.
They had a weekend board meeting in a retreat up in the mountains above, in the hills above Melbourne. And to consider what, if anything, to do about Holmes of Court. And the consensus was that BHP was so large and so important to Australia that they couldn't be bothered by an upstart like Holmes of Court. And I told the directors that in the experience of the United States, that one just simply could not ignore a threat like that. I told them that they had, I thought they should be tougher and more defensive and act against Holmes. They chose not to do so, and then the thing built up. Holmes of Court was financed by some of the banks in Australia. And he leveraged his position to beat the band. Got enough money to buy a significant portion of BHP shares.
What could they have done to be defensive and tougher?
I think they could have moved more quickly to increase the price of BHP shares would have done a slick way to do it.
How could they have done that?
Well, I don't know. There is a law in Australia against this company purchasing its own shares, so that they finally got around to that by doing a deal with Foster's, is the name of the company. By doing a deal with Foster's to exchange exchange positions. Foster's bought, say, 200 million Australian of BHP shares. BHP bought, say, 200 million of Foster debentures. And the chairman of Foster said, went on the BHP board. So
that would have kept Holmes at court from gaining so much.
Well, yeah, if they'd done something like that sooner, they might have avoided a lot of it. They let Holmes at court get up a good head of steam before they took him seriously.
Mm-hmm. Is he still around?
No, he died. He got in financial difficulty. He did so much on leverage, borrowed money, that when his world began to crash, he had a real problem. But he did manage to salvage an estate in England. And he died with her.
So that was all going on at the same time that they were trying to keep their business going.
Yeah, it was sure an interruption.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some other things that went on. You know, the man who represented BHP in the negotiations with Burlingame for the acquisition of Utah was David Adam. David Adam was a director, an executive director of BHP, was a lawyer, and in the early days of my association with BHP, after the acquisition, he was a guy that I found most helpful. Well, introduced me to BHP. And David Adam made a play unseat Brian Logan. And all very strange.
Logan was on the board.
Brian Logan was, by that time, was now the chairman of BHP.
Okay.
And no, Balderstone was chairman of BHP. Logan was the CEO. And David Adam had aspired to be the CEO, and made a move thinking that he had support on the BHP board. And I became Ballerstone's request, the go-between, between the chairman, Ballerstone, the CEO, Wilson, and David Adam. And they, I guess they were sitting in the same, within a stone's throw of each other, but not speaking to each other, and I would get a telephone call in San Francisco, come on over, we've got a problem, you've got to speak to David. I'd troop over to Australia, and I'd be with David, I'd be with Brian, I'd be with Jim. Just really very strange, but I think all the hands saw me as being no threat. I was not, I did not aspire to be top figure in BHP. I was nearing retirement age.
You were foreign.
A threat to no anybody. A threat to nobody. And so I spent more time trying to iron out problems between the problem between Lowton and Adam really and Ballerstone was trying to hold the lid on the kettle.
What sorts of problems were they?
Well, of course, Adam attempted to get enough backing from the board to oust the then CEO, which is crazy, utterly absurd, but he tried it and he failed. So then the big question, now what do we do with David Adam? And that's where I came in. I was a go-between and all that stuff. I hated him because I liked David Adam. I considered him a personal friend. As a result of all this baloney, Adam didn't speak to me for about 3 years.
Oh my.
It was awful.
You were going to, continuing to go to meetings together though all this time?
Yeah.
He stayed on the board.
Well, finally, the result of all this hassle after about 6 months was that David resigned. Maybe it was almost a year before he left, but power struggle, I guess, is the other thing you could call it.
So who succeeded Ballerstone then as
chair? So then, when Lowton Lowton became chairman about the time I retired, John Prescott became CEO of BHP. So it was a lot of fun.
Do you have any connection with them now? You've resigned.
Oh, personal? That's all. No connection with him. Then Lowton and his, Brian and his wife are going to be over here in September. I received a fax from him the other day. We'll get together. Nice people. made some good friends. In Australia.
Now, Curries have kept a home there.
Yeah, they have a place on the beach in Queensland.
Mm-hmm. Did this tempt you?
Beg pardon?
Did this ever tempt you?
No. Australia's too far away. I have a home in Hawaii that I don't get to, you know.
Uh-huh.
Been over a year since I've been there. If I had one in Australia, I'd never see it.
And of course, your children weren't there with you to...
No, they were not.
No, it wasn't home for them. What about GE? When you severed your connection with GE, then that was... Was there any remaining connection at all with GE?
No, only personal. Park, by this time, Parker and I were very good friends. And I liked John Burlingame, saw him from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
Matter of fact, this last year we went on a cruise to up the coast of Norway with the Parkers and the Burlingames.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. Well, that's good.
Where are we now? We're rambling about BHP.
Well, what about the operations continuing? Or is there anything significant about the operations after BHP took over?
Of course, the significant thing was that we brought Escondida into production.
That's the biggest thing.
Yeah.
So you had...
The coal operations were, I recall, going fine, well managed. You know.
The tape is just about over.